He's got one of the biggest audiences in the history of the world. I mean, this guy is unbelievable. Try speaking for 3 hours without taking calls. Taking calls is easy. Okay, I'll answer this one, I'll answer that one. He goes for 3 hours, and he's got an audience that's fantastic.
The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
David Bowe's in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. This is part of The Big Show, where we tackle the biggest issues nationally, internationally, and locally here on The Big Lead. And we start with
The Big Lead, Big Local.
The state court is, a state appeals court is giving new leeway to the possibility of an income tax. Thanks to an appeals court, it looks like the city of Seattle lost their case. Their particular local income tax is still unconstitutional because it is graduated income tax. In other words, it doesn't charge the same rate for all of that particular type of income. However, the appeals court tossed a significant portion of a law that had banned localities from imposing localized income taxes at all. So the court basically ruled that the 1984 law was unconstitutional and that this would open up the floodgates of cities, perhaps, implementing their own income taxes. We spoke with Jason Mercier of Washington Policy Center earlier in the show, and he said there is a legal way now for cities to impose an income tax, but not the way Seattle officials are doing it.
Well, this has been the most frustrating thing about this entire process, is that there is a way to change the Constitution. There is a way to change state law. What we shouldn't be doing is having our elected officials willfully and knowingly violating a state law or the Constitution in hopes of getting judges to do something that the electorate won't. And that's all this comes down to. They can go to Olympia and propose a constitutional amendment, but they know the voters don't want that. So instead, they're trying to get the judges to do something that they can't pass through the democratic process. And that's just incredibly frustrating when you look at that quote again from the city of Seattle today saying, this is good for us. Now we get to try to get the court to change the constitutional rulings.
Yeah, and by the way, there have been attempts to actually implement a constitutional amendment to ban income taxes in Washington State. Currently, we can have a flat income tax, that was dismissed a couple of years ago. Senator Phil Fortunato proposed a constitutional amendment to ban income taxes. And I remember the debate. I was watching it on the Senate floor, and everybody was saying, it's a complete waste of time. Nobody's talking about an income tax. Nobody's talking about that. We're wasting our time. It was funny how many different state senators stood up to talk about how it was a big waste of time, therefore wasting tons of time talking about what a waste it was and that nobody was talking about it. Then one of their colleagues, who you got to hand it to him, at least he had the courage of his own convictions, Senator Hasegawa, stood up and said, well, I actually do favor an income tax. And you could hear this groan, you know. And there was one other senator who made an inference that she supported an income tax. And, of course, the city of Seattle and others were talking about income taxes. So it was very clear that there was plenty of people talking about and planning to find a way to implement an income tax and trying to do so in a way that would allow the courts to kind of push it upon us rather than go through the elected representative process, because nobody wants to take the responsibility for it because it's been unpopular with voters now 10 times. So, there was an easy solution here. You amend the Constitution, get rid of all of it. And then you make yourself the income tax-free state all the time, which is what people want. It gives Washington State a marketing leg up for other businesses from other states. But we have a sustained effort here to try to implement one in Washington State, and that effort continues. This gives the court, the state Supreme Court, more interest in this particular case, which is deeply troubling to those who have opposed income taxes and this kind of approach, this piecemeal approach to trying to implement income taxes come hell or high water is getting more serious as time goes on, which is kind of shocking at this point.
The Big Lead, top national.
Donald Trump and his Twitter fallout continue. I see producer Chris wrote, Trump racist tweet fallout. He's apparently writing for CNN and MSNBC here. But I would say this, there's it's there it could be a racial. It could be that Trump was speaking about the one representative, Representative Omar, who came from Somalia. It could be that Trump was ignorant about the about each of them being United States citizens and three of them being born in the United States. So there's a number of things that are possible, but a lot of the media is focused on just hammering the word racist over and over again. In fact, I think there's a study done. It's been repeated over 700 times based on my own viewing of CNN during the show, which has a constant banner now about Trump's racist comments. It's a new obsession here. Britt Hume is under fire on Twitter right now. He's the former ABC News correspondent and Fox News anchor because he pointed out that he thought that they were xenophobic, but he thought that use of the term racist was wrong because inside the Trump comment, it does not imply that there's some kind of racial supremacy. It just becomes an ignorant xenophobic comment. And of course, because he didn't go along with absolutely everything negative said, he's now persona non grata, public enemy number one, or at least number two, in the Twitterverse right now, which is one of the reasons why I hate talking about Twitter all the time, because everybody's obsessed with trying to find a way not only to insult each other, and the president's at fault for that, but then they're obsessed with continuing that. And basically everybody acts the same. Everybody kind of acts like Trump, where nothing you say is going to change anything. They just shoot back some new insult. And that's how Twitter works. CBS spoke with some Trump supporters about whether or not these particular tweets were going to cause a fallout with him.
I know some people don't like his tweets and they think he's crass, and I that's why I voted for him.
It's unfortunate he had to do the way he had to do it. He's doing the only way he can to get this country back.
Now, I never agree with that kind of nonsense. I don't think people have to be that way. I don't think you have to. I think there's been leadership like, you know, Governor Walker of Wisconsin, Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, amongst others, that show that, you know, people can be powerful reformers without being crass and without being rude. You know, that's not Trump's style. So these folks aren't panicked about it because I think it's the same reason as during the campaign. When you find out Trump said something horrible, they would say, well, yeah, that's Trump. In other words, they're not taking what he says literally. They're taking it as kind of an emotional salad, so to speak. But in Congress, the House is going to vote on a resolution condemning the comments. I read a part of the resolution. I don't know if it stayed the same since prior to the show. But again, it looked like instead of condemning the comments as ignorant or problematic or even xenophobic, they go the extra mile and then imply that these particular comments therefore justify every horrible behavior that ever existed. And I don't think that that's going to last. Representative AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, said that Trump speaks this way because he doesn't know how to defend his policy.
Weak minds and leaders challenge loyalty to our country in order to avoid challenging and debating the policy.
Now, here's what I thought was interesting about that. I actually was thinking almost that same thing last night. Like when you say to somebody, hey, you know, you don't like it, just leave. And that's true whether it's, you know, a college campus, a city, a state, or whatever, you know, oh, just get out of here. You saw that with some people talking about some Seattle issues recently. I think it is weak because you've gone off of what the policy was you're debating, and now you're more directed toward the individuals that are actually doing the talking. So it's a change of topic from what's being said or what the policy is to who's saying it. And so I thought Ocasio-Cortez had a point. And then she launches into a personal attack on Trump, which is, again, you know, she was just saying when you launch these personal attacks, it means you're not ready for your argument. You know, and it's the most base way to argue, and it doesn't actually apply to policy. And then she goes off and does the same thing, which is, you know, part of the problem. In the meantime, Kellyanne Conway, unsurprisingly, stood up for President Trump. She got before the media. And then it was one of those incidents where somebody was probably saying, we used to say this about my kid brother from time to time. We'd say, don't get on my side. And then we would make a joke about whenever one of us was fighting, we'd say, don't get on my side.
The president said today he doesn't have a racist bone in his body. I've been by his side for over three straight years. People show their truth selves in private often enough. I have never, ever heard that man say anything untoward based on race in my experience. And that's very important.
And then she asked a reporter for his heritage and said, I'm Irish and I think, what was it, Irish and Italian or something. So, you know, it just became super awkward at that point where everybody keeps playing the, yeah, I'm Irish and Italian cut. And you're thinking, what does that have to do with anything? So just leave well enough alone. You had a cut. Stop talking. Stop. Just stop it. Take the Bob Newhart approach from Mad TV and just stop it. $5 for that little piece of advice that could save so many people so much hassle.
The Big Lead, Big Local.
King County's having a two-day summit that starts today examining gun violence through a public health lens. Now, when I saw the story about King County, and I think it was Representative Peterson who proposed this. It was McDermott, I'm sorry. Am I correct on that? Where they wanted this approach to gun violence because, of course, they're obsessed. Yeah, it was Representative or County Council Member Joe McDermott. He sponsored legislation last year that led to this summit. They want to approach gun violence through the medical lens and say it's a public health problem. And they say that we need to encourage health officials to ask about whether or not there's a firearm in the home. He said he wants doctors and nurses to get comfortable asking about access to firearms and suggesting steps to ease high-risk situations, such as temporary firearm transfers, helping patients or family members get domestic violence protection orders or extreme risk protection orders. You know, all of this stuff seems like the extreme protection order stuff should have been covered already. Secondly, I don't think doctors need 2 days, right? I mean, if you just want to give basic advice, I don't recommend asking everybody about firearms because that's just going to tick people off about you invading their privacy. And we all know that there are a number of people out there that just want to be able to confiscate guns eventually and keep this on some kind of a file. And it's going to make people less likely to share information with public health officials if they start asking about a bunch of things. But telling people proactively, look, especially if there's revelations of abuse or violence, telling them about what they can do and what they need to do and telling them what they should do if there's a firearm in their home, I have no problem with that. But the collection of information, there's a separate agenda there in that, and on the actual if there is a firearm in your home. And that can become a problem unless, like I said, if there's specific violence there and you're in fear, then I think it behooves you to say, hey, look, you need to tell the authorities about this. You need to tell or call this number. Or that makes sense. But again, doctors have gone to school for years. They're super smart people. Nurses, they've been around the block. You don't need 2 days. You just need a pretty straightforward approach. And you can let people know. And I think it could move faster. The Sobering Center in downtown Seattle is now out. The building was sold, and that's left a number of individuals who are chronic alcoholics in emergency room beds or sleeping outside. The difference between the Sobering Center and an emergency room bed, $69 a night for the Sobering Center, roughly $3,000 a night for the emergency room. So in Seattle, there's an increased urgency to try to find a new location for the Sobering Center. The thought was maybe Georgetown, but Georgetown neighbors said, not in my backyard, thanks. You in downtown Seattle can keep it. So the question is, where? Where do you put it in Seattle when nobody wants it? It's a good question, but, you know, at some point, the folks in Seattle are going to go broke trying to answer it. And then finally,
The Big Lead, top trending.
Peter Thiel, the early Facebook investor and Trump supporter, weighed in on the Democrat field on Tucker Carlson last night. He was making news because of his call for the FBI and the CIA to investigate Google to see if Facebook's AI research or Google's AI research, artificial intelligence research, had been infiltrated by Chinese espionage. Now, he says that the candidate that scares him the most...
Who's the most impressive candidate in that race, do you think?
Well, I'm most scared by Elizabeth Warren. You know, I think she's the one who's actually talking about the economy, which is the only thing that I think the thing that I think matters by far the most.
Yes.
And then I think almost all the others are equally unimpressive in the sense that it's all identity politics of one flavor or another. And I wouldn't want to rank how unimpressive they are, since that would you'd be forcing me to rank the different identities and which one's more privileged and more special. and that would be a dangerous thing to get into.
All right. So he's not too impressed, except for Elizabeth Warren, because she's taking the James Carville approach. It's the economy, stupid. I think actually that's the wrong approach this time, though, because back when Clinton took the approach, it's the economy, stupid, it was because we were having a light recession and George Herbert Walker Bush had just come off this tremendous foreign policy triumph. But people were kind of worried at home that things weren't prosperous. There's fears that we're going to return to the Carter years of malaise. And then the recession actually turned around before the election, but you'd never know it from the media. And the Clinton campaign did their best to make sure of that. And they won on a promise of economic revival, which actually started before Clinton took office. Now, there was a divided government during that during a big chunk of that time, and the Republican Revolution, but that's for another time. In this case, the major poll problems with Trump are precisely because of story number one that we started with today. It's story number two, the Twitter stuff. It's Trump's general persona and attitude and crassness that get in his way. His poll numbers tend to go up when people aren't really thinking of him because they're focused on, you know, jobs and the economy and what their family's doing. And then when he talks and is doing, you know, his verbal battles, then people get weary. And so I think it was candidate Cory Booker who was saying that the people are looking for a stable president. Now, I think he was trying to make a dig about you know, the allegations of mental instability that I don't think hold any water. But in terms of a calming influence and a dignified or returning dignity to the office, you can't underestimate the power of that. Because remember, George W. Bush used that to some effect against Al Gore and ultimately won a squeaker of an election. Never mind. That was big lead number five. Black home ownership at an all-time low. The rate has fallen 8.6 percentage points, according to the latest census data. While Hispanic home ownership is on the rise, black home ownership rate has fallen 8.6 percentage points since its peak in 2004. It's really tragic. This is the first time in more than two decades that Hispanics and blacks, the two largest racial minorities in the U.S., are no longer following the same path when it comes to owning homes. It's better news for the Hispanics and bad news for black Americans. Now, the study suggests that black homeowners are more likely to buy homes in heavily minority neighborhoods, and they've not benefited from the rise in home prices since the foreclosure crisis. This represents a real and sustained challenge to making sure that opportunities are at their utmost for black Americans, and I think it shows a significance that is underserved by both sides of the current political debate. David Bowe's in for Tory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Welcome back to the Tory Monson Show. You're on 97.3 Cairo FM. I spent the last few minutes watching a CNN presentation, and I feel the dumber for it. It used to be I could tune in and actually learn something about some part of the world that I didn't know or some policy I was unaware of. Now I feel like every headline's breaking news. Someone was talking about something that we were already talking about, but they said it in a way we don't like. Now let's get 19 panelists on, because apparently nobody wants to watch our anchors. It's just a painful experience all the way through. Not so painful is this part of the Tory Monson Show, where we play the best audio of the day. Audio that's so good, we call it awesome.
This is Tory Monson's awesome audio. Clips of the day.
White House advisor Kellyanne Conway said the so-called squad, the four congresswomen President Trump criticized on social media, has lost moral authority. Yes, they've lost moral authority, claiming they voted against humanitarian aid.
Well, the Democratic response is very predictable. You hardly need to cover it. It's always racism, sexism, xenophobia, and it's getting tired. These four people in the so-called squad that have done squat in Congress, other than pose on magazine covers and go on late night comedy shows and cause trouble in their own caucus, were under fire a couple short days ago by senior Democrats, elected officials, Greg Meats, William Lacy Clay, Nancy Pelosi. Even Ayanna Pressley threw a little shade at Nancy Pelosi yesterday in that so-called press conference. It was more like a gaga in front of a bunch of supplicants who never challenge their factual assertions and just cover anything the four of them say. It's Nancy Pelosi said they're just four people. They only have four votes. A glass of water could have won their districts. These four women are distinctive for one important reason I want America to know. They are the only four Democrats to vote against any form of humanitarian aid at the border when that vote was taken 2 weeks ago.
There you heard it. Now, that would have been much better audio if we'd have played the sounder first.
Number three.
Yeah, that would have made it much better. But, you know, with Nicole coming back tomorrow, I felt like her flight might have landed by now. So I know that she'd be listening. That's a producer of the Dory Monson Show. And so we had to screw up at least once. Yes.
Oh.
To make her feel needed.
Okay, you know, sure.
Like, yeah, she's got to come back. Otherwise, Chris is doing such a good job here.
Right.
The powers that be might be thinking, you know, it's cheaper if we just, you know, move Chris over here and just, you know, leave Nicole out there at the airport.
So, Nicole, if you're listening, we miss you.
That's desperately so.
Please come back.
And Dory, for the love of God.
Dory.
Yeah. Get back here.
Sure.
All right. So in other news, Katy Perry, Katy Perry's back in the news. About time, by the way. I feel like there's been a drought of Katy Perry news. Now, there was a time when I'd have said, can we talk about something other than Katy Perry? But thanks to Twitter, now I'm desperate to talk about Katy Perry. She opened up on an Australian radio show and said she practices an ancient remedy to curb the effects of getting older. Does she have the elixir, the fountain of youth?
Number two.
I had an enema one time, and I actually felt like I was walking on air, which I believe may have been a song of yours once. But
yes.
I felt like I was walking on air afterwards.
Yeah, you definitely feel more energy, and, you know, it basically, like, gets all the crap out of you, every pun intended.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's ancient ways to heal yourself besides, you know, just taking a pill. Which is something I always love to investigate. And Orlando is very all about kind of that new age way of living.
There you have it. You know, George Burns, apparently he was keeping a secret, the key to longevity, enemas. Now, the thing that struck me about this is she has an attitude there that a lot of people develop, which is they're always looking for the wisdom of the ancients when it comes to medical care. And I always feel like they didn't have science, right? For the most part, in the ancient world, the life expectancy was so short. They're desperate for anything. And so, you know, you take a look at a lot of those ancient practices around the same time, and instead of thinking about the ancient wisdom, you just want to fall on the floor and thank God you're alive now. So, not suffering the way they did with the medical quote-unquote cures that they had to endure. So, you know, even now, I bet you we'd want to give a delivery system for that that's a slightly different than the days of old, so to speak. I mean, it shows that we live in a, shall we say, we have a very now-centric view of ourselves, you know, where everything's on the now and, you know, things are horrible for me now, therefore they were always better, or they'll be better later. But right now, they're really horrible. And instead, we might want to just take a deep breath, take a look back, and think, you know what? Things are going pretty well right now. Michael Collins, the command module pilot who was part of the legendary Apollo 11 crew, but did not get to walk on the moon, which, is that not the worst job? I mean, he's so close to glory, right? I mean, he's in the part of the coolest crew ever, and then when he shows up at the schools with all the other astronauts and everybody's talking about the astronauts, he introduces himself and they say, who? That Liam Neeson movie? What's going on? Anyway, he spoke with the Today Show about the moon mission that happened 50 years ago this week, and he's finally getting his chance to be in the sun, so to speak.
Number one.
Once in orbit around the moon, Collins said goodbye to Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin as their landing module headed to the surface. Collins, meanwhile, stayed up in the command module, the only ride home.
Once those guys drift off, what are you thinking?
Bon voyage.
I think you got a fine-looking flying machine there. You go to space back, you're upside down.
Orbiting above the lunar surface, Collins was often out of radio contact, though as the command module ventured to the far side of the moon, he did hear this.
Houston, Tranquility Base here.
landed.
But as for those famous first words,
it's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
He missed the whole thing.
Did you hear Neil Armstrong's?
No, no.
Didn't hear it?
No, I don't remember.
One small step
for a man. No, I don't remember hearing that.
Collins was flying around the other side of the moon, as alone as any human had ever been.
It's more than half of the time you're in contact with Houston. It's blather, blather, blather in your ear. So, in a way, it's kind of nice to have that 40 minutes to yourself back there. I kind of enjoyed it.
And Collins still doesn't mind that he wasn't down there, too.
Was there any part of you that was like, I wish I could have done that, too?
Well, sure. I wish I could have walked on the moon, but I can say with the utmost honesty, I was thrilled to have the place that I had, to be one-third of John F. Kennedy's culminating dream. So I have absolutely no beef whatsoever.
Now, doesn't that story make you feel like you're part of a better place? You know, like taking a step back where, you know, I feel like you're in Mayberry or in some kind of Tom Hanks film where you just feel like everything's a little lighter. Everybody gets along and there are real heroes and wonderful things that we can all accomplish together. That's why we included that story from today on Awesome Audio. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Awesome Audio brought to you by Brown Bear Car Wash. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. It might feel like the apocalypse every time you hear that Dory is gone. But in this case, being the end of the show, the final segment of the show, it is officially time for
today's sign that the end is near.
And it should be today's signs that the end is near. Now, turns out artificial intelligence can now solve the Rubik's Cube faster than any teenager. Yes, apparently it's super smart teenagers can generally solve a Rubik's Cube in about 50 moves. Artificial intelligence now only takes 20 moves. And this is considered a dramatic increase in the ability of computers to think for themselves. In this case, the intelligence system capable of solving the Rubik's Cube does it in a fraction of a second, and it learned how all on its own. It is, each cube features billions of possible moves and completion paths. The fact that depressed me when I read it, because I thought, I don't think I ever solved a Rubik's Cube once it was messed up. I just took the stickers off, put it back to where it was, and I think gave it to another kid. I got too frustrated. That spatial stuff just was not my forte. But what it shows is the robots are coming, growing more powerful as the day goes by. Also, it turns out teenagers are buying Croc footwear, not just for its comfort, but also because it's ugly, specifically because it's ugly, according to this report from CNBC. In fact, teenagers are buying so much of this ugly footwear, the company's stock was upgraded to buy from neutral, and because of their solid traffic during the summer season. Juliana, a 17-year-old from New Jersey, requested only her first name be used, admitted that many of her friends are wearing Crocs because they're seen as ugly. Quote, people want to wear it because it's gross. It's like rebelling against whatever society thinks is wrong. I always thought they were ugly, but then everyone started wearing them and it just became a trend. Everyone I know has at least one pair. And that's why Crocs are popular. Made me think of parachute pants because they were super popular when I was in junior high.
That'd be a good combo.
Oh, that what Crocs and parachute pants. That if you want ugly kids.
I think kids wearing those clothes that are ugly is pretty awesome.
It is. Bring them back. Bring back the parachute pants along with those Crocs and see what ugliness really looks like. By the way, I remember the parachute pants craze when I was a kid, and I thought, man, I'm going to be popular. Kids are going to like me. I'm going to go get myself a parachute pant, get some parachute pants. And I remember there was a certain brand, I forget what, but you know, they wanted like $54 for the pair, $80 for the pair, and I was like, no way. And then when they went on sale on the clearance racks, which should have given me a hint that they were out, you know, I got them for $10. I thought, well, now we're talking. Wore my $10 parachute pants to school. And then I just felt dumb the whole day. I don't think I ever wore my other pair because I bought two because they're only $10, except to go outside and play in the snow. So it was a bad experiment. And finally, the House – now, I say finally, it's not the close, but the State House representative has passed an amendment ordering the Pentagon – not state, but the federal – House of Representatives has passed an amendment ordering the Pentagon to review whether the United States experimented with weaponizing ticks, as in the blood-sucking creatures that that attach themselves to your skin. They want to know whether the Department of Defense experimented with ticks and other insects – regarding its use as a biological weapon between the years 1950 and 1975. The congressman who sponsored the amendment thinks it may perhaps be linked to Lyme disease. And because nobody's ever heard of insects carrying disease outside of, you know, biological warfare. And I say that sarcastically for those of you who are really concerned about going outside now. Police, according to this news story, police are warning in Tennessee of the possibility of meth gators, alligators high on meth. Why? Well, because you'll recall in Alabama there was a fugitive that had fed meth to his attack squirrel and created a super aggressive squirrel. Well, now they're saying so many people are flushing meth down the toilet that they shudder to think what would happen if an alligator eats one of those meth packages and gets all methed up. It's kind of cool because right now, you know, in the theaters, there's that movie Crawl that features alligators on the attack. So just imagine if they were high on meth and what that movie might have looked like. They warn people not to flush meth or other drugs over the weekend for fear of creating these meth gators. Although I think if you're a meth head, odds of you being concerned about the public impact of meth gators is pretty low. And finally, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the birds in Marlborough, Massachusetts are on the attack. Numerous people are reporting various attacks of birds right on the top of their head, specifically red-winged blackbirds. More than 250 million of the birds live across North and Central America. So Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds is now coming to a neighborhood near you. No explanation is given for the attacks.
For 11 years, you've heard me say, I'm listening. Well, you were listening, too. And for that, I am eternally grateful. Good night, Seattle.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.